We're doing Parashat Ki Teitze, and ordinarily we begin our Parsha class with an overview of the Parsha. This week the Parsha has so many mitzvot, it has about 20% of the mitzvot of the Torah in this week's Parsha, it's impossible to do an overview. The overview would be the whole class. So what we'll do is we'll try to go mitzvah by mitzvah slowly through the Parsha, highlighting important points. So our Parsha begins with war. If you go to war, so there's a special mitzvah of Eishes Yefas Tor. The custom was that when nations would go to war and they'd see they were losing, so the women would get all dressed up. The man, the Jewish man who's been out at war, he's away from his family, he's out there and he's tired, and they're trying to seduce him. So the Torah says, ordinarily, when you capture the enemies, so you could have them as servants, they're going to work in your home, and the Torah gives us rules of how to treat them. They get a very decent treatment in a Jewish home. But what happens if a person is taken by a woman's beauty? So the Torah permits him to marry her. The Torah says, if I tell you don't marry her, I know you won't listen. So what am I going to do? The Torah says, I'll tell you could marry her, but you just have to do a certain procession. Bring her home. Have her shave her head in a second. Grow her nails or cut her nails. And change from all those beautiful seductive clothing that she's been wearing. She has to wear ordinary plain clothing. She has to spend a month weeping over the fact that she just lost all her family. She's trying to seduce you, but that means you're going to marry her and she's going to move out. And after that procession, then if you're still interested in her, you can marry her. So what did the Torah do? The Torah said, yeah, you can have that, but after you do a certain procession. And in so doing, what the Torah basically did was help a person overcome his wrong inclinations. And that's one of the keys to overcoming our desires. If a person wants to start smoking, so he knows he shouldn't, it's a bad idea. So you tell yourself, I'll start tomorrow. If you tell yourself, I'm not going to do it, that's very hard. But if you say, let's just wait a day, so then you could conquer yourself. You say, you know what, let me consider it tomorrow. Very often, a person's sitting on the web, and he's tempted, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, his mind is a little fizzled, and he's tempted to do things he knows he shouldn't do. So if he says, nah, I'm not going to do that, he might succeed. If he says, you know what, I can do this tomorrow. There's nothing wrong if I'll just push it off to tomorrow. Tomorrow he'll be sober. And tomorrow, when he thinks it through, he'll say, why would I want to do that? Why would I want to destroy my soul? Why would I want to destroy everything I'm trying to build? The problem is that people are sitting on it, and then they just surf. And then they end up where they shouldn't be. So the Torah tells the guy, you want her? Fine. Just do a small procession and then see. And then a person really overtakes himself. The Talmud says, what happens if a person is driven by lust? He's overtaken. He suddenly feels like he must go and do something he shouldn't be doing. So the Talmud says, don't go to the woman of ill repute down the block. You go to another town, wear black clothing, cover yourself with another layer of black clothing, go where no one knows you, and then do whatever you want. What's the Talmud really saying? By then you'll start feeling, what kind of bum am I? What am I doing here? And then you won't want it anymore. It's not telling you, yeah, here's the open check. Just change your clothing, go to the next town and do what you want. No, the Talmud's saying, you do that, so then you'll, en route, you'll start thinking to yourself, what am I doing here? Yes, Vinny.
Oh, why didn't God just create man in a way where he won't need that procedure?
Good question for a Thursday night. It's a good question. Remind me on Thursday, yeah.
He carries this out, is he a good person?
Which one? With the woman?
Which one?
The case in the Torah or the case in the Talmud?
In the Torah.
Well, King David learned this parasha and he misunderstood it. King David thought there's a mitzvah to marry this woman. So he went through the whole procession and then he married her and she became his wife. The daughter of Gat, Macha. And the Torah tells us, what happens if after the 30 days, you're not so interested? So the Torah says, you can't now sell her as a servant. You just did something here. It's not fair. You can't abuse her and use her. You send her home. That's it. She's free to go. If you wouldn't have done this whole procession, so then, okay, she's your captive, then there are rules. But once you made her go through this whole procession, so then the Torah says, you don't want to marry her? Then let her go free. Let her do what she wants. Next case in the Torah. A man has two wives. One he loves and one he hates. And then he has children from both women. So the Torah says you can't take what's legally coming to one son and give it to another son. Your firstborn son is entitled to a double portion. You cannot give that to one of the other children. What happens if a person has a son that's so rebellious that he's already proving to be a terrorist? He's robbing people. He's a young man. He's just hit bar mitzvah. And he's robbing people and he's drinking wine and he's eating meat before it's even cooked. And you see the guy is becoming a glutton. And you try warning him and you bring him to the sages and you bring him to the elders and the courts warn him. And you see this is what's happening here. So the Talmud says there can be an instance where the kid will get the death penalty if he keeps showing that that's the route he's going on. So the Talmud says, why are these three stories juxtaposed? That's what King David didn't know. That the Torah didn't tell you to marry this woman. On the contrary, the Torah said, you know what? You could go through this procession and then you can marry her. Where the Torah's idea was, after this procession, you're going to calm down and you'll realize there are so many good Jewish girls out there. What am I going with this girl for?
Does that mean she converted?
Later on she converts, but what's her conversion worth? We all know that deep down inside, she only got into this because she wanted to seduce him. That's not a conversion that we like. So yeah, she says, I believe and I'll perform. But then what happens? You're in the marriage and suddenly she starts washing your milchik dishes with a fleishik sponge. So you tell her, honey, you know that's a fleishik sponge. And she says, you know, that's a rude husband. And you say, wait a second, don't you want to keep a kosher kitchen? And she says, if it'll make you happy. And you say, what do you mean me happy? She says, okay, I'll do it. You start getting these little hints. And then the kids start hearing these little hints. And then you end up with a son that says, hey, what do I need all of this for? His mother tells him, you know, yeah, your dad is always careful to eat kosher meat. Of course we eat kosher meat in this house. You know, those little subtle messages, well, they penetrate. So then the kid grows up and says, what do I need this for? And there the Torah says you end up with a son that starts saying, I don't need this. I'm going to do what I want. And even if it means stealing from my parents, and even if it means stealing from people on the streets, I'm going to get what I want in life. So the Torah juxtaposed these stories to tell us, you take a woman who isn't really interested in Judaism, and you won the war, and she tried to seduce you, so then you go through the procession, and then you say, okay, we're married. So then what's going to happen? You're not going to have a fun marriage, and then you'll end up having a situation where you don't really like her afterwards. You only got into this because she was trying to seduce you, because it was a time of war. And then what's going to happen? The kids will turn on you, and the kids won't want to keep the Torah. And that's exactly what happened to King David. And so when King David was running for his life, and he was a leper, and all the elders left him, and the majority of Israel turned on him and joined his rebellious son Avshalom, so he was contemplating leaving Judaism. Yeah, it's important to know, King David had his moments too, where he said, maybe that's it, you know, this isn't working for me. And his Rebbe, Yeroha Ya'iri, comes to meet him. And he sees King David walking all alone, covered with boils. He's barefoot. All the people, the majority of Israel has turned against him. God's left him. And King David is contemplating leaving monotheism. And Ira Yairi tells him, stop, don't do it. And King David says, but what's going on here? And Ira tells him, who told you to marry his mother? What'd you marry a woman who wasn't interested in this religion for? And King David says, but it's a mitzvah in our parsha. And Ira Yairi tells him, no. It doesn't say it's a mitzvah to do this. The Torah permitted it because the Torah said, if I tell you no, then people won't be able to stand up to the temptation. So the Torah came along and told you this. But you see, the Torah warned you that if you do it, this is what's going to happen. So yeah, you did it, and that's exactly what happened. You had a son who's not interested in the religion, who's turned against you, who raped your wives, who's on the run to kill you. Yes, the Torah warns you this would happen. So You did it to yourself. What are you upset at God for? God forewarns you in our parasha that that's the procession.
What if the woman doesn't want marriage, even though she's still beautiful and like attractive and still wants?
That's a good question, but we're short on time. The answer isn't the 1 minute answer. We're up to Sheni. The Torah tells us what happens if a person blasphemes. So, blasphemes. He curses and he voices his complaints towards heaven in a curseful manner. So then the person can ultimately get the death penalty, and then a person can get hung for it. Now, the Torah gives us a special mitzvah. Even such a person must be buried that day. It's not respectful to leave him hanging around, and it defiles the land. And so we try to bury a person right away. So here in Jerusalem, sometimes at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, you'll hear the sirens going off, and they announce that so-and-so passed away, and his burial is at 12 o'clock, at 1 o'clock in the morning, because we're very careful. This is our tradition here in Jerusalem. Even at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, we bury a person. A month ago, a friend of mine's father passed away. It was on Tisha B'Av. It's mamash a month now. He passed away on Tisha B'Av, and on the eve as Tisha B'Av was going out, he passed away. So they wanted to bury him, but there's a whole procession. We purify the body. So this guy came from Jerusalem, and he decided, we have to do it tonight. So the burial procession started at 1:30 in the morning. We all got home after 3 o'clock. Because that's this pasuk. Where possible, we bury a person right away. So it's true, some people take it very far. But the Torah's mitzvah was, when such a person is hung, bury him. Now the Torah adds a word. The Torah says it's a curse towards heaven if you leave him hanging. Why is it a curse towards heaven? Because what are people going to say? You know why he's hanging? You know what he did? And then they start talking about what he did. And when they talk about what he did, so they're really mentioning blasphemy. They're mentioning a person who cursed towards heaven. And that's not good. And here the Torah really taught us a phenomenal concept that should really give us a little bit of insight as to what the media is doing to us. The Torah says, if someone did something terrible, even though they deserve to be hung, don't leave them lying around. We don't want people talking about it. If you talk about something that's a degradation, then you're degrading once again. I was once walking in a supermarket in the United States, and I hear the radio, and they're talking about terrible things that people have done, and they're all in shock, and they keep talking about how could someone do something like that. Well, you know what? If you're talking about something terrible, you end up desensitizing everyone. When the media talks about people who commit suicide. So in halacha we say the person doesn't even get a proper burial. We don't want to encourage anyone to do it. They publicize the massacre where people shot up their friends in school or school children. What you're really doing is you're desensitizing everyone. The more you talk about it, after the Columbine massacre, so then threats started happening in mass. Because by talking about something, you desensitize the world to it. I think that the news has to think responsibly what should and shouldn't be said. You know, I had a friend who committed suicide off the Empire State Building. Okay? Jumped off the Empire State Building and died. And what was shocking to me was that initially someone sent me an email, did you hear about so-and-so? I hadn't heard. I was in this country. This happened in New York. So I do a search for his name and I see the news. So I saw very little on the news, so I did a search, Empire State Building. You know what I discovered? That 2 years earlier, I lost another friend off the Empire State Building. Two friends committed suicide off the Empire State Building. And I hadn't known about either one. If you start publicizing that this is what's happening, then you're making a fad out of it. You're causing people to think about it. When the news discuss incest, and the news discuss rape, and the news discuss all kinds of defiled activities, what the news is really doing is it's making it a part of our psyche. It's making it a part of what we talk about, what we think about, and then you're really encouraging people to think about it. So the Torah comes and says, yeah, the guy deserves to be hung, but don't leave him hanging around. Bury him. This isn't something to be discussed. You know what the rabbis did? When a person was executed, they'd execute him just before sunset. And after executing him, they'd put him hanging on a tree for a split second to fulfill. The Torah says hang him. So after the person was dead, so to fulfill the mitzvah, they'd put him on a tree, hang him, and after a split second, one person would hang him up, and the other person would take him down and bury him. And we're so careful, out of respect for the deceased, that the sword that was used for execution was buried with the person, the rope that the person was hung on was buried with the person. Even though the person sinned and he got the death penalty, the Torah tells us we're supposed to treat him with dignity to the point where we don't even leave the rope lying around. We don't want you to use that rope for something else. The rope that was used for execution was buried with the executed. Yes?
This was first only to Jews. I mean, you say like about Hilary Maxima, was it for like deliberately...
Again, it's a broad discussion. The fact that we hate evil doesn't mean that we spend time discussing what evil does. Those are two different things.
Also, someone who commits suicide... He's not buried,
I didn't say he's not buried.
Not given proper burial.
Correct. The Torah tells us if you see someone's lost animal, you have a mitzvah to return it to your friend. And if you don't know who he is, then you have a mitzvah to hold on to it until the guy shows up. Now what happens, you're walking on the street and you see a pen on the ground. So the average person doesn't care for his pen, and he's not going to come around looking for his pen. So Rav Nevenzel said, little things like that you could hold on to. But you can't take that too far, because in yeshiva, people do want their pens. Now, I recommend you guys invest in a permanent marker, two permanent markers, one black and one silver, so that you could write your name on things that are black. That's why you need the silver permanent marker, and the black permanent marker for things that are not black. It's not such a big investment. You know, I was once on a bus from Bnei Brak to here. I left my hat on the bus. I got my hat back. So it cost me, what did it cost me? 5 shekels, 7 shekels to get a permanent marker. I saved the value of a hat, 200 shekel, 250 shekel. I lend my ladder out. So my ladder has my name on it. Not such a big investment. I'm saying it's not a big deal. You write your name on a pen, you get, you know, it doesn't cost you too much to write your name on a pen. You'll get your pen back. But if you find someone's pen, say if it's in a yeshiva and it's a pen that's not of substantial value, you should still put it in the Hashav Saveda place, because people will get their pens back. Or leave it. Leave it in its place. If you're out on the street, so then today we're so wealthy, at least here in Israel or in the United States, that the average person isn't going to spend any time looking for a pen that he dropped or a paper clip that he dropped and stuff like that. So today we're more lenient with that. When a person comes to collect his object, you have to question him to make sure it's his. I found in my house a check for 8,000 shekel. That's a lot of money. And it was an open check. So technically, money doesn't have a siman. Meaning if you find money, you could keep it. Unless it's in a store. So then it might belong to the store. Because the store has takes ownership because it's on its property. So I call the guy who wrote the check. And I ask him, you know, do you remember who you wrote the check to? And he tells me it's a guy who was working at our house. Now, being that it's an open check, maybe the guy who had the check already passed it on to someone else. So I can't give it back to him yet, right? So I go over to the guy who he says he wrote the check out to. And there were 2 days left till the check, till the date on the check. So technically you couldn't cash the check yet. So I asked the guy, did you lose anything? So the guy says, yes, I lost a check from so-and-so to this amount. So he gave me simanim. He gave me signs that it was his. Is it crystal clear it's his? No. But he said to me, look, I'm about to call this guy and tell him to cancel the check. Because I don't know where the check is, and I was giving myself until today to find that check. I've been looking for it for a week. So if it were money, you don't have to give money back. Money, we say, there's no simon on. But if it now that it's a check and it has his, he knew the exact amount, he knew who was the one who gave it, etc. So that's a simon. And being that he has the power to cancel the check, so bichlal he has, and the guy who gave him the check said, you know, if you're not giving it back, I'm canceling the check. So okay, so then there's no reason not to give him back the check. But the Torah tells us, "Ad rosh achicha oto," you wait until your brother comes to seek it out. And from here we learn that you're supposed to seek out the guy who's coming to make claims. Meaning you ask him for simanim. You don't just say, "Hey, who lost something?" And a guy says, "I lost a wallet." You say, "Here, have the wallet." You give him the wallet with 30,000 shekel. No. You ask him, "Give me signs. If it's yours, prove it." And a guy should be able to give you signs. So we have a mitzvah to return a lost object, but that mitzvah comes with a few strings attached. A, it has to be worth our time. And B, when a person comes to claim it, you have to question him a little bit. You can't just give it to him. You have to check that he's the real owner. The Torah tells us that if you see your friend's animal stumbling along the way, you have to help him out. Because that's part of the mitzvah of caring for animals, and that's part of the mitzvah of helping to load the animal, to unload the animal. We have a special mitzvah in the Torah that men are not allowed to wear women's clothing, and women are not allowed to wear men's clothing. So today you have jeans for men and jeans for women. You can't call that men's clothing. Men wear rings, women wear rings. You can't call that women's clothing. In most societies, men don't shave their arms. In most societies, men don't shave their armpits. So that would be like wearing a woman's clothing. That would be prohibited. In the days of the Shulchan Aruch, men didn't look in a mirror too much. So if a man would stand there fixing his hair, you know, in front of the mirror, that was considered dressing up like a woman. Today, men do look in the mirror, you know. Men look in the mirror and get themselves fit, and that's okay. A person isn't supposed to walk outside looking like he's just come out of World War II. You know, he's supposed to look decent. But you still shouldn't be spending time to get every little hair in its right place. Again, today, this goes by the norms of the times. Meaning, if you're in Ireland and men wear kilts, you can't say that. That's a woman's garment. That's the norm over there. It really is defined by the norm of the time and the place. But it still does pertain. What happens if it's a wintry night and you left your coat at work? You want to take out the garbage, and you're not embarrassed. You want to wear your wife's pink coat. That's okay, because you're wearing it to protect yourself from the elements. You want to wear your wife's slippers. She wants to wear your slippers. Again, you're wearing it to protect from the elements. You're not really wearing it as a garment you're going out wearing. So there, that's okay to wear. A man could wear a woman's garment, a woman could wear a man's garment. That's okay. We have a special mitzvah of shiluach haken. If you happen upon a mother bird together with her babies or with her eggs, so then you cannot take the mother with the children. And you cannot take the children when the mother is present. You have to shoo away the mother and then take the children. We don't exactly understand the idea behind this mitzvah, but there are deep Kabbalistic concepts where the mitzvah really represents the Jewish people. We are represented by those eggs and by the little chicks, and our whole history is encompassed by this whole story. One day, if you want, we could go into what represents what in this whole story. The Torah gives us a mitzvah that when you build a new house, so put a railing on your roof so people don't fall off the roof. And there's a special prohibition. Don't leave something that could cause harm in your home. So what does that mean? You're not allowed to have a pit bull. You're not allowed to have a pit bull that's going to run out and bite the mailman or people who come near your house. We used to have a woman up the block. She used to walk around with her pit bull. She used to say, "He doesn't bite. He doesn't bite." I was dying to take some mace and spray it in his face and say, "It doesn't bite, it doesn't bite," right? You know, I didn't bite, right? You're walking with a pit bull and he's growling at people. It's not right. The halacha says you're not allowed to leave something in your home that could cause damage to people. So that means, let's say you have an open socket and people come by, you know, a person could by mistake try to turn on the light switch and touch the socket. You're not allowed to leave that there. In many apartments that we rented, so the old Kiryat Moshe apartments, sometimes you pull out a plug and the socket comes out with it. Those of you who live around here know that that's fairly common. It's fairly unusual to find the socket that doesn't do that. So I had more than once that I was on my way to Shachris and suddenly the socket comes out. So even though I have to down with a minion, I'm not making it to that minion. I have to stop what I'm doing and put the socket back in and unscrew and re-screw. You better know what you're doing, guys. Shut the electric here. This is Israel. It's 220. You don't want to get killed. You have to put it back in. You can't leave it around where someone could get hurt by it. So this is a prohibition. Lo tasim damim beveitecha. You're not allowed to have a ladder that could really collapse on someone. You'll say, but I know it's a rickety ladder. But what about your neighbor who borrows it? What about when your wife tries climbing on it? You may not leave something in your house that could cause people to get hurt. So the prime mitzvah is to put a railing on a roof. If you're going to use that roof, if you have a rooftop that's in use, so there has to be a railing on it. But the applications are not only on a rooftop, but also in other areas of our life. We have a biblical prohibition to plant kilayim. That means, let's say I have a watermelon, and I want to plant an orange tree. Now it's a dry season, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the orange seeds and put them inside the watermelon. So as the orange seeds grow, they suck out the water from the watermelon and they'll grow through the watermelon. So what I've really done is I've crossbred the orange seeds. Let's say I have an apple tree and the apples are Granny Smith apples and I want to grow a gentler type of Granny Smith apple. It's too tangy for me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to graft. I'm going to take the branch of the Granny Smith apples and cut it in a diagonal this way. And then I'm going to take some, what's a sweet apple? A branch of, what? Pink lady apple. And I'm going to cut it also on a diagonal, fit them together, bandage them together, and then over time the two branches fuse. That's what's called grafting. So I've taken two types and grafted them. So that's also kilayim. Grafting two trees, two types of fruit. Maybe two apples isn't kilayim, that has to be discussed. So grafting two types, planting vegetables in a vineyard. So that's all types of kilayim. And the Torah says if you plant kilayim in a vineyard, then the vineyard becomes prohibited, meaning you have a vineyard, you're living in Hebron, you're growing grapes, and then you decide that between all the grapes, you're going to grow a vegetable patch, you're growing cucumbers. So then that whole vineyard can become usur, or at least a large segment of it. Yes?
You can benefit from people like combining different fruit trees, but you can't
right.
actually do it yourself.
How come you asked? That deserves a long discussion. We have too many mitzvahs to cover tonight. The Torah prohibits us from taking two types of animals to plow. So the Torah gives its classical examples of a donkey and an ox, but really it means any two types of animals. Any two, is it genus or species? I don't remember. Species? Not genus? I don't remember. Which one is it that you can't crossbreed? The genus or the species?
You mean like it's not possible?
Correct.
Genus?
I once knew this. When I was your age, maybe. I don't know. So then it's probably the genus that you're not allowed to crossbreed. So, just a second. So the Torah says you cannot plow with two animals together that are different breeds, that are different types of animals, an ox and a donkey, or any two types of animals. Now, what's the prohibition here? What's the logic here? So there are different understandings. One understanding is that it's just painful for the animal. You know, they have different strengths. The ox and the donkey have different strengths. If they're both pulling the plow together, you're doing something that's unfair to the donkey. The donkey can't keep up with the strength of the ox. Another understanding is that the ox chews its cud. So the donkey keeps looking at the ox and he sees he's eating all the time. And the donkey keeps wondering where to get all that food from, right? So it's painful to the donkey to keep watching him eat. In line with that, I once mentioned to my father that it's a lot of fun to order the kosher meal on the plane because everyone boards the plane tired and they usually get the super kosher, like the glatt kosher meals. They want to get them out of the way. They don't cost you extra today. And if you order a glatt kosher meal, so you get your food first because the waitresses, they want to serve everyone together. So they get those unusual guys, the glatt kosher, the vegetarian, the special meals, they serve them first and then they serve everyone else. So I said, you know, it's a lot of fun. You order glatt kosher, you get your meal first, you can finish eating, go to sleep before everyone else even starts. So my father said to me, he said, I don't know, I can't eat while everyone's sitting around hungry. That's true, okay, that's a correct point. That's, you know, it's a sensitivity the Torah wanted us to have. The Torah prohibits us from wearing shatnez. Shatnez means if you have a garment that has wool and linen mixed together. So what's wrong with wool and linen mixed together? Okay, so the simple reading is, it's a chok, it's a statute. The Torah didn't tell you why. Torah says, don't wear a garment that has wool and linen. Where do we have that? If you have a very expensive suit, any suit that'll cost you more than $500 can have shatnez. The cheaper suits, it's rare that they'll have shatnez. They'll try to tell you that they do, and the custom is that we check them for shatnez, but realistically, it's not so common. The more expensive suits, that's where you start finding shatnez more. Now, you have shatnez laboratories in Mash Arm. You have a shatnez laboratory here around the corner. If you go up to the light and you make a left, so there's, on your right-hand side, there's a laundromat, and that laundromat will give your clothing to be shatnez checked. It costs money. It's a laboratory. They actually check threads from the garment, from throughout the garment, to make sure there isn't wool and linen mixed together. Now, if you have a garment that's 100% polyester, you have nothing to worry about. There's no wool, there's no linen. I mean, they're not investing too much money in your 100% polyester. You go to many of the stores, they'll tell you, this is viscosa. Viscosa is polyester, yeah? They'll tell you, they have different fancy names here in Israel for polyester. And at the end of the day, they're all polyester. Once the seller tells you, this suit can go in the washing machine, usually means it's a polyester suit. If it's polyester, you don't have to check. Sometimes they do have wool, a blend. Many suits have a blend of wool and polyester. The advantage being that if it's 100% wool, then one downpour and your suit looks like a rag. If you mix it with polyester, so it'll maintain its shape even if it gets wet. So many suits are a blend of wool and polyester. And then you have to check, because very often they use the insert that gives the body to the lapel or the neck or the shoulder pads or the buttons. They use linen. Linen is a much stronger fiber. Now, the custom today is that we check all suits. If you bought a suit for $100 or $200 and you didn't get to check it, so if it's a regular cheap suit, so until you check it, you could technically wear it. You shouldn't wear it because then you'll forget to check it. I told you guys I collect donations of suits to give out to other people. So I once got a donation from a guy, $800 and $1,000 suits. And I got a pile of suits. So I gave them out here in the Machon. And I said to every person, I don't see a label that says it was shatnez checked. Now this person is an Orthodox Jew who I would eat in his home. You know, he's observant. He's fully observant. But I don't see a label that says he checked it for shatnez. So it could be he didn't want a label because he didn't want to look like a frumi. But you can't wear it without checking. And lo and behold, the suits were filled with shatnez. This guy bought expensive suits and his whole life he was wearing shatnez. Hugo Boss, I don't remember the names. It was Armani. One was a Boss suit that I remember. I think one was an Armani suit. Very expensive suits. So the guys here were very happy. They had to invest like 150 shekel to clean it out of all the shatnez. It cost a lot of money because it was filled with shatnez. But like one guy said to me, I got a $1,000 suit for 150 shekel. Not a bad deal. You know, okay. But you do have to check. The cheaper suits you should also check. That's the custom today. Everyone checks their suits for shatnez. Women's clothing also have to be checked for shatnez. So let's try to give one understanding as to what the issue is with shatnez. The Torah says, we'll give two understandings. There are certain things that were done in the temple, and the Torah says, I don't want you to replicate it in your home. So we're not allowed to replicate the ketores, the special incense that was offered in the temple. Even though the Torah tells you how to make it, you're not supposed to make a replica in your home. That's for the temple, not your home. You're not supposed to replicate the special oil that was used to anoint in your home. You're not supposed to make a replica of the temple. Let's say a guy says, I got a great idea. I'm building a new house. I'll build it the form of the temple, right? Here's the Anit room, here's the Ulam, here's the Heichal. I'll have my bedroom will be like the Kodesh Kodoshim, yeah. Bad idea. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to make a room that's supposed to be a replica of a room in the temple. The Torah wanted that the temple be sacred, and you're not making replicas in a home. So the curtain, the paroches, was made of shatnez. The paroches was made of wool and linen. It was a special blend of wool and linen. So one understanding is that the Torah, in line with this idea, the Torah said, I don't want you to mix wool and linen in your home. So that's one understanding. Another understanding is that the first fight in world history was between wool and linen. Cain He grew fruits and he brought an offering of flax seed, of linen seeds. And Hevel grew sheep and he brought an offering of wool. So the Torah says these two items that were the source of the first fight, because after their first offering, God accepted Hevel's. God did not accept Cain's. Cain was really the initiator. It was his idea to bring an offering. So Cain gets jealous of Hevel, and then ultimately Cain murders Hevel. So the Torah says, I don't want these two together. Don't wear the two of them together. Because the first fight in world history began with the combination of wool and linen together. So that's another famous understanding that's offered. Yes?
Does shatness start with like one thread of the opposite kind, or is it a percentage has to be?
The simple understanding is one thread. But it needs more depth. That's an oversimplification, but the simple understanding is one thread. Yes, that's what the Talmud says. But again, I'm oversimplifying. It deserves a broader class. There's a whole tractate Kilayim, yeah? Yes?
How far does it go into not building a replica of the temple? I mean, you can't build a room, but can you build, assuming, you know, kids build whatever model?
Yeah, that's okay. We have a mitzvah of wearing tzitzis. So the Torah calls the tzitzis gidilim. Gidilim literally means a string that's wound around another string. So our tzitzis has two components, right? You have the part that's knots and winding around, and then you have the parts that are strings that are hanging. And the ratio should be 1/3 to 2/3. So the Torah gives us a mitzvah of tzitzis, and then the Torah discusses marriage. So the idea, this is a source for our minhag that when a person gets married, that's when he wears a talis. We wear a talis under the chuppah, and that's one route they want to suggest for this custom, that we don't wear a talis before marriage. That's the Ashkenazi custom, except for the Yekis and the Sephardim. Okay, yes.
Wouldn't they become possible if you put tachlis on them, since the fish is extinct and you couldn't get the dye exactly how it used to be?
No. We have a prohibition of marrying a male Ammonite or Moabite because they made a boycott against us. They said they're not going to sell to us. So up until recently, if I bought in honor of Shabbos a Coke or a Pepsi or an RC, I'd look to see which was cheapest. And then I heard that back in the 70s, when the Arabs made a boycott against Israel, and they said that any company that sells to Israel will not, they won't purchase from that company. So all the companies, I don't know about all the companies, but Pepsi said they're not selling to Israel. They caved under the boycott because there are many more Arabs than there are Israelis. And Coca-Cola continued selling to Israel. Coca-Cola said on principle they're not caving in. And ever since I heard that, I buy Coca-Cola. Now Coca-Cola is much more expensive than Pepsi. Mm-hmm. But you know what? The Torah tells us you don't even marry a nation that boycotted us. The Ammonites and Moabites, they boycotted us. And because of that, the Torah says, you were traveling in the desert, you needed their help, and on the contrary, they said we're making a national boycott against Israel. So the Torah says, don't marry into them. The Torah tells us a very strange mitzvah. It says, don't distance an Edomite because he is your brother. Meaning, even though they also boycotted you, but at the end of the day, they're your blood relatives, they're your brothers. So that teaches us a phenomenal concept. Sometimes a person looks at his brother and he says, what a bum. Why should I have anything to do with him? The Torah comes and teaches us, even if your brother's wrong, once he's your brother, there's a certain relationship that should be there. Gamarnu. He's wrong, okay, but he's still your brother. There was a famous story here in Israel about 25 years ago. A group of Jews got together and decided that they can be terrorists too. And they started planning how to bomb Arab buses. And they were caught, and they were put to trial, and they were actually planning bus bombings. And one of those people, when he was going to court, so a friend of his came to stand with him as he was going through the proceedings. And this friend was a very famous left-wing Knesset member. So people asked him, you know, you're a left-wing Knesset member. How come you're standing with him when he goes to court? So he said, ideologically, we're very different. But we're friends. We were friends before the story. Obviously, I disagree with his actions. Obviously, I disagree with his stance. But now it's over. He's not doing anything. Now he's in trouble. Now he's in court. Now he's facing penalties, sitting behind bars for who knows how many years. So now the situation is that my friend is in trouble. The fact that what got him into trouble is something that I'm against ideologically is irrelevant. Now we come back to square one. He's my friend and he's in trouble. And when my friend is in trouble, I stand by him. So the Torah says, an Edomite, even though they were wrong, they also boycotted us. But now you look back and you say, but at the end of the day, they're your brother. The Torah gives us another mitzvah, and we'll have to pick up here Be'ezat Hashem on Thursday. You go out to war, be extra careful not to do anything wrong. Meaning, there are times of danger. And at times of danger, a person has to be extra careful to do what's right. And this opens up a Pandora's box, philosophically. If God's watching over everything, so what difference does it make if it's a time of danger? People like to say every bullet has its mark. If you were meant to die, you would have died anyways. And you see here in the Torah that the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says in times of danger, you have to be extra careful. You have to be extra careful spiritually. When I sat with my students who were going into the army, so one of the things I kept reiterating to them is that in the army, you're in situations of danger. And that means that you have to be more careful. To be clean, to speak cleanly, not to say foul jokes, not to speak foul language. What does the Torah say? You're going out to war? Be extra careful not to do things that are wrong. I always told them there are three things really, you have to be careful about in the army. One is not to speak foully, not to say dirty jokes, etc. Two is not to say lashon hara, because our tradition is that when people speak badly about one another, so then in heaven they lose the protection they would have had in going out to war. And three, be careful to pray. You're at a time of danger. That's the time to pray. So be careful to be focused in your prayer, as short as it is. Be careful not to say lashon hara, to speak badly about others, and not to speak foully. And here we'll pick up Be'ezat Hashem on Thursday night with the mitzvot of going to war. Many details, Be'ezat Hashem, we'll pick up here Thursday.